Good afternoon and welcome to Faith and Reason. This is your host, Dr. John Pinero, and for the next hour, we're going to be talking with Dr. Dennis Marshall, professor of theology at Aquinas College. I've known Dennis for many years now, I think 10 years. And in fact, when I moved to Grand Rapids, it was Dennis and another professor, Chad Gano, who helped move me into my house, and they commented on how little we had, which I thought was interesting because we thought we had an awful lot. But they were workhorses that day, and I still appreciate it. And since then, Dennis and I have grown to be good friends, and I would say compatriots, at least in the fighting the good fight in Catholic education. And so I thought it would be great to have Dr. Marshall on the program to talk about Catholic education, the liberal arts in general, why we're educated, what it is about the human person that makes us want to know, all those kinds of things. And maybe we'll get a chance to talk about some of his classes that he teaches at Aquinas College as well. So Dr. Marshall, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Now, some of our listeners will have maybe attended your Authenticum lecture at Sacred Heart last year or come to listen to you at Aquinas talk about the liberal arts. I've been impressed with your ability to really make the liberal arts and Catholic education understandable in a really concise way and in a clear way. And I think that's a great to great benefit of your students, your clarity, which is something that philosophers are supposed to be really good at. And so I should note to our listeners that you also teach a philosophy class at Aquinas, the philosophy program, the philosophy class that is part of the Catholic Studies minor. But it's also something I think theologians are or ought to be good at, too. So it's good that you have that. Why don't we start off and you tell us what you see as the purpose and the big sense of a Catholic education.
Well, I think that we have to understand, along with St. Augustine, that human beings are made for God. He has this interesting saying that in the consideration of creatures, we ought not exercise a vain and perishing curiosity, but ascend to what is highest. So the ultimate goal of our knowledge is a knowledge of God. And everything else in that sense, every other type of knowledge that we apply with regard to the world in which we live, to the things that we do, these are implicitly ordered towards God, but not explicitly. In a Catholic education, we come to understand what our ultimate end is, what our ultimate perfection is in that knowledge and love of God. And so consequently, a Catholic education should be ordered to that particular end.
So would that mean we're talking about God in every type of class, every discipline?
No, not at all. I would think that there's an old methodological saying that says the nature of a thing determines how it is known. This is Aristotle. This is St. Thomas. And actually, what that means is that every particular thing that we know has its appropriate method for study. So when one studies for chemistry, for example, one utilizes methods to understand that reality that's appropriate to it. As I tell my students in my God course, God is not the answer to every question that we ask. Sometimes beer is the answer. And so consequently, you have to utilize, quite frankly, the appropriate method according to the object that is studied. And what determines that method is the object. So chemistry requires a different way of seeing chemical compounds, for example, than, say, metaphysics. You can't use empirical method to understand ultimate first causes. In the same way, you can't use empirical method in order to come to an understanding that God exists, because those things that do exist in an empirical way always point to their source rather than God being capable of being accessed through empirical methods. There's no way that we can prove that God exists, for example, by using scientific method.
And the modern world, I guess I would say the contemporary world, is that at the root of atheism then, or agnosticism? That is, this is the only method they think there is to know, and so since they can't prove that, they say, no way, I don't think God exists.
I believe that the modern turn is precisely that turn away from a transcendent understanding of divinity to a purely immanent understanding of the world. And since reason's operation geared towards earthly things is dominance, then it's easy to come to an understanding of through science of the world in which we live in order to dominate it for our benefit. But you can't dominate God like that, and so consequently, he gets left out of the equation. If God cannot be demonstrated to exist according to empirical methods within the modern world, then God, by that very fact, doesn't exist. So what you have really is a methodological exclusion in principle of the question of God in the modern era, which presumes that the sciences are the sole and only means to understanding what is true.
That Pope Benedict has spoken, now Pope Emeritus Benedict, has spoken pretty profoundly on that, I think, calling it the truncation of reason and trying to restore the use of reason to its proper function. When you were talking about technology there and talking about domination of nature, it made me think of a discussion I had in my Christian View of History class this last semester, where we were talking about magic and superstition. We were reading through G.K. Chesterton's Everlasting Man, and it occurred to me, I think C.S. Lewis was the one to say this, but it may have been rooted even earlier in Chesterton, that he said, look, superstition and magic are really on one side, on the one hand, and he put science and religion on the other. That is, rather than putting these as opposites, as so many moderns think they are, said science and religion both aim at uncovering truth according to their proper methods, as you've just said, but magic, and on the other hand, also technology, which many would relate to science and modernity. Magic and technology then are on the other side because they aim at domination. Superstition aims at somehow domination of the natural world, not understanding it, in other words. The other thing that occurred to me as you were speaking is more St. Augustine. When we confuse the ends of the city of man and the city of God, the way we run into trouble, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Should we just spend more time reading Augustine?
Well, I think that it would be a good start, but I think St. Thomas Aquinas corrected Augustine. Of course, I'm going to say that teaching at Aquinas College, but it's true.
Okay. So in what sense?
St. Thomas utilized a more appropriate philosophical method for theological investigation than Augustine did. The Aristotelian philosophical worldview is superior to the Platonic. The Platonic worldview has a tendency to overly spiritualize things without giving due regard to the physical. Aristotle's philosophy in his hylomorphic method pretty much gives much more attention to embodied natures than a Platonism would.
But the hylomorphic, what does that mean?
St. Thomas and following St. Aristotle. St. Thomas
following... He darn near was in the medieval
there
period.
You go. Nobody
he?
Knew that. St. Thomas following Aristotle would say that created things are comprised of both form and matter. Things in this world are comprised of form and matter. So the form of the thing is what shapes the material into the kind of being that it is. So when you talk about human beings, our souls inform our bodies. And our souls are not simply generic, amorphic, spiritual realities. They are specific to not only our being, but our person. So, for example, I sit here as a male. My soul is male. It informs my body. It shapes the type of person that I am. My wife, of course, would possess a female soul, and her body is informed by that soul according to its form. So, in this particular regard, then, what a thing is not simply matter, but it's also form, this kind of idea that gives it shape and causes it to be the type of thing that it is.
So, you're saying, then, that Thomas, compared to Augustine, Augustine would neglect the body and this fool of you more so than Thomas.
More so than Thomas. He would not ignore the body, but he does not give the emphasis that St. Thomas would.
And you think that's because of his lateness and background?
I think it's also his Manichaeism, the influence of his Manichaeism, and the other forms of Gnosticism that were floating around in his day and age that inescapably influenced the way he thought. What's amazing with St. Augustine, and what I really appreciate, is that as you read him, you can see him struggle with these things. And because he's so informed by Scripture in his thinking, there are a lot of things within his thought that becomes corrected because of revelation and because of Scripture. But there are other things that don't get the same kind of development or treatment. And that could be because he didn't have the time, or didn't think it was important at that moment to treat, and so on and so forth. There are a lot of elements that one has to take into account when reading Augustine.
Was Augustine more of an occasional writer, like many of the early fathers? That is, he's writing to combat a particular thing at any given time, rather than sitting down and trying to come up with a Summa, for instance.
No, I don't think that he was necessarily an occasional writer. I think that St. Augustine's writing was an expression of his restless heart seeking God. This last spring semester, I taught my students St. Augustine's Trinity, in which we read his Trinity, and his theological method is very much a reflection and contemplation on all the possibilities that are presented, that one can think about a certain thing, and then coming to understand their inadequacies in light of Scripture, their benefits in helping us understand the divine mind a little bit more, and so on and so forth. So that as you read Augustine, you get the sense that you are ascending from those things that are nearest to you to that which is highest, so that even when reading him, he thinks that coming to understand even the most little things about God brings the greatest joy, brings the greatest perfection, and even more so than simply knowing about quarks or neutrinos, things, and the best garlic sauces to put on your shrimp or something like that.
Do you happen to know that, by the way?
I don't. I wish I did. But St. Augustine, I think, in his method, he's demonstrating to us what he himself is doing in his writing. He's seeking to know God more deeply and to rest in that knowledge of God as much as he possibly can. And I think that more than an occasional writer, he's giving expression to this movement within him, and that it happens to correspond with certain answers that people are giving at the time just gives him a further reason to write, not to mention the fact that he's a bishop and he has the spiritual care of the souls under his of his flock in mind. That's something that also has to be taken into account when reading Augustine.
Did he write on education?
He wrote a book called Against the Skeptics, the Contra Academicos, in which he deals with a certain intellectual trend that dealt with skepticism, that says that we couldn't really know anything at all. And he spent some time blowing them out of the water, so to speak. It was part of his early writings before he shortly after he converted. Okay. And so most of his, a lot of his thought at that time is immature. His more mature thought, like the Confessions and the Trinity and the City of God, those are at least the three things that one ought to read in St. Augustine.
Well, I mean, even encountering that kind of skepticism in St. Augustine doing that, back in the 4th and 5th century, that it makes me think of how little things change in some ways when I think of something like modern skepticism. And one of the things that always occurs to me and that I find striking is, and this occurs to me having so recently read Everlasting Man, again with my students, is that Yeah, the early pagans especially were very interested in truth and responding to the world as it is, and sometimes controlling it, sometimes not controlling it, just responding to it and hoping for the best, at any number of things. But what they were interested in is truth, and because of that, they were eminently, they were able to be evangelized by Christians in a way that is much more difficult with moderns. And I think for the modern progressivist especially, they look on the past as there's nothing there. The progressive mind, of course, tells itself that whatever's in the past is bad. Otherwise, what would we need? We wouldn't need progress, would we? And but they don't even know how to ask the right questions, which means they're not even going to find the right answers. But we go back to these the ancients and the pagans. They're asking all the right questions. They're not always getting the right answers, but at least they were reflective enough to ask the big questions and to think about the universe in that type of way. You know, why are we here? What really do I owe my fellow man? What do I owe God or the gods, etc.? And I don't find particularly the modern atheists to be asking those kinds of questions.
No, well, I don't think so. I think
but they think they're more advanced, though, than those in the past, but they're not even astute enough to do that.
Well, they may think that, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they are. And this is one of the particular problems. If we look at the ancient Greeks and the kind of questions that they asked philosophically, going all the way back to Anaximenes and Anaximander and so on and so forth, they want to know the way things are. And so they ask questions, what would seem to us to be silly. Well, is the world in which we live, is it made up of four elements, earth, air, fire, and water, and so on and so forth? Yeah. But they're coming, however silly that might sound to us today, at least they had an understanding that this kind of investigation was worthwhile. And that it was important because to know the way things are meant that then we could govern our lives in a manner that is worthy of the way things are, instead of creating a fantasy world for ourselves and then living within that according to our own lights. So they demonstrate in this questioning, in this questing, if you will, the openness of the mind to ultimate being and ultimately God. This type of openness is going to be really important, especially when Christianity moves out of Palestine and into the larger Greco-Roman culture and evangelizes it. So that's something that's important to understand, that these early Greeks believed that reason was ordered to a type of wisdom. A wisdom which was understood as knowing the source of things and then knowing everything in relationship to its source. Because if you knew the source of things and if you knew how things were related to that source, then you would be able to judge wisely the things of the world, so to speak, in order to live your life well.
That's largely the Stoic worldview, right? Which
well,
was very,
yeah.
very popular.
It's also Platonic and Aristotelian. I mean, you find this kind of idea rooted in those. But when you get to the skeptics, they have no confidence in the mind's ability to know anything at all, and they say that you can't know anything. But what's really silly about that is that it's based upon a contradiction. Because if a skeptic says that you can't know anything, they at least know one thing, and that is that you can't know anything. And so, in a certain sense, in a real sense, they undermine their own position by saying that you can't know anything. Because they do know one thing. And that is that you can't.
Or they
know.
Think that, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. And what is their response when you point that out?
It depends upon how honest they are in their seeking. Usually, skeptics are pretty much deceived, self-deceived, and sometimes they're disingenuous. It depends. Some of them will simply respond by saying, "Well, that's simply your worldview." They will lock themselves in their own particular worldview or their own particular perspective and try to retreat into a solipsism, but that's pretty problematic, because their statement that you can't know anything is not simply an individual view. That's a universally valid law,
exactly,
according to them.
Yep.
And once you challenge that, skeptics, by and large, if they're serious in that you can't know anything, this type of skepticism, then they find themselves up against a serious challenge to their particular worldview. How invested in that worldview one is depends upon one's response.
Thomas Merton writes that the kind of atheist he most feels sorry for is the one that, not the one you're describing, but the one who really wants to believe and can't. Hmm. Can't seem to make that leap. This is Dr. John Pinheiro. You're listening to Faith and Reason on Holy Family Radio, Kalamazoo, Grand Rapids. I'm talking today with Dr. Dennis Marshall, professor of theology at Aquinas College, where I also teach in the history department and in Catholic studies. And we're trying to cover the very large topic today of the purpose of Catholic education. So we've been spending some time with Augustine, and much earlier than Thomas. And I know you like to get us up to Thomas if we were going chronologically. But in a general sense, then what I'm hearing is that, so if God is the ultimate end of man, then God would also be the ultimate goal of education. So each discipline's going to pursue knowledge about that which they're studying according to their own methods. So what then would or ought to a Catholic curriculum look like? How much science? How much physical education for the body, which as we were talking about, is not unimportant? There's a saying in Catholic education, particularly in high schools, you know, mind, body, and spirit. You'll see some combination of those in the slogans of a lot of Catholic schools at the grammar school level and at the high school level. But how about that? What would it look like? What should the mix be?
Well, I don't know if I could get into specific percentages, but
okay.
Let's just talk about physical education first off. In order to be able to contemplate God, which is our ultimate end, one has to have a healthy body to do that. If we're racked by pain or we're ill, then we're going to be more focused in on those immediate experiences and seeking relief from them rather than seeking to transcend them and commune with God via prayer or study. So there should be at least enough physical education within a Catholic school in order to facilitate a healthy body. But in my mind, the emphasis should be not so much on physical education, but on the disciplining of the mind to know what is true. And this means then that going to school, attending a Catholic college, for instance, is not about activism. It's about study. We don't study in order to transform the world. We study in order to understand the world and to understand ourselves and to understand ourselves in relationship to God. Only when we understand these things in their proper proportion, that is, we put ourselves on the road to wisdom and then begin to live out those things through our daily lives, does the whole question of acting within the world emerge. But it's unfortunate today, in my mind, that most education is geared towards a political end. That most higher education, I'm not saying this is necessarily true about Aquinas, but that most college education focus on giving their students some kind of skills in order to make it in the world and in order to transform that world. The thing is that to be sure, it's important for us to be able to keep body and soul together by having some kind of vocation or career that puts a roof over our head, for example. But to transform the world? Into what? This is a serious question. And how can you transform the world unless you know what it is, where it's come from, and where it's going? You understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
So in this particular sense, then, activism for activism's sake, which I think has its roots in Karl Marx's philosophy of the 19th century, when he says that, as he surveys the history of philosophy up to him, he has this great line. He says this, up to this point, philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. That is, they sought to understand it and its relations and so on. This is what wisdom is. Well, he dismisses that and he says, the point is to change it.
Mm.
And this kind of idea, since the turn of the 20th century, has pretty much dominated educational systems down to our present day.
Students, I find students are they're very driven to want to do that. Why do you think that is? Is it because it's pounded into their head from early on? Is it just that natural, I would say, God caused drive to seek out justice, that sort of thing? I mean, is it the call to achieve some kind of social justice, is it bastardized in some way and turns into this transformative?
I think that part of it is that we're created in God's image and likeness, and part of that means that we are given dominion over the world in which we live, and that means that we have to act with all due respect to the Creator within the creation in order to contribute not only to our salvation but also to the world's salvation. So we're co-partners with God in that, and in that sense I think that there is some intrinsic drive within us that God gives us by reason of our being created in His image and likeness for this kind of activity. But I don't want to put too much emphasis on that, is that I think that it's easier to act than it is to discipline the mind to contemplate. Anybody who, and you can just test this on yourself, or anybody who's in the audience can test this on themselves. How difficult is it for us to sit down and carve some quiet time out of our day in order to pray and study, to quiet our minds enough to where we can attend truthfully to what it is that we're doing? We find this quite difficult. And of course, because we haven't, so inculcated with activity from our youth that we always need to be going, we always need to be doing, we always need to be involved in something.
This is the child who's involved in five sports and five clubs and has no time to to play.
Yeah, I think that's part of the problem, is that the expectation is that we fill up our time with busyness, because if we're quiet, we might have to tend to those things which are really important, like what's God calling us to do? Who's God calling us to be? And those kind of questions require quiet space, a safe zone, if you will, that is preserved from worldly distraction, that allows one the opportunity to contemplate these things.
Right.
Now, let me just say something here, is that in the Dominican tradition, prayer and study are virtually the same thing. In other words, in order to love God through prayer and to know God through prayer is really no different than to know God through study and to love God through study. St. Thomas Aquinas says that the purpose of studying is to understand the way things are. And if God is the greatest thing in being, right, and to understand Him, then to study about the world, to study the way things are, is a part of this contemplative exercise. It itself is a type of prayer. I don't think people appreciate that these days. If you look at college campuses across the country, you will see that one of the largest segments of the college campus is the student activities division. God forbid that we don't entertain our students. You understand? And if we don't preoccupy their time, then they're going to do something drastic. Oh my gosh, like study. They might do something drastic, like actually read some of the stuff and think about some of the stuff and discuss some of the stuff that they are learning within their school. And the thing is that if they did that, And if they were attentive to that, and if they they contemplated that, that's what would be really transformative. It's not the action, a person's action in the world that transforms the world. It's one's being transformed by God that subsequently transforms the world. And I think that our world has it backwards. We want to rush out with the best of intentions but no clue about the way the world is and transform the world. And the consequence of that is that we make it worse. We make the world worse. The road to hell is paved with good intentions. If we have no clue about the world and the way that it really is, then our actions within it are going to contribute to the chaos within it if we don't really understand what's going on.
So then a properly ordered college education in general, but properly ordered, ought to provide substantial leisure time for not just for the study related specifically to the classes, but for the types of studies that grow out of that, right? So you're reading one thing and it makes you want to know more about something else, and you have the time to do this because you're not being inundated with so many activities and requirements and bloatedly huge majors, right, with so many credit hours. You have no time for what used to be called electives, but those are something that are fast disappearing as college education gets commodified and turned into a consumer-driven business. Right. I mean, colleges have to stay open on the one hand, so I get that. So, in a way, a product is being provided. But on the other hand,
do they really have to stay open?
Do they?
James Shaw wrote a book called Another Sort of Learning.
Yeah.
And the title is much longer than that. I don't recall it all.
James Shaw, longtime Georgetown professor.
That's right. Yeah. It's unfortunate that in our world today, education means being educated and possessing a degree, a certification that says I can do X job, or that I am capable of doing this particular skill.
It's what Newman called a servile education.
Exactly.
Right? In service to a particular thing.
It's not a liberal education. It's not one because the thing is if we contemplate our lives in relationship to its ultimate end, my career is going to be taken from me. Whatever money I make is going to be taken from me. Ultimately, even my life is going to be taken from me. So it's not my house. It's not my career that defines me. It's something more profound than that. But if I have buried myself under a hill of techno speak, if I see myself only as a function within the larger society rather than as a person, then I'm going to have no way to really judge my life. And this is why, not every question that we ask, God is not the answer to every question that we ask. If my son asks for a cookie and I just say God, then he goes away with a hungry, belly and probably a disgusting idea about God. And perhaps properly so. But the question about God, God answers the question of the meaning and purpose of our lives. And in that sense, then, to study the humanities, to study the liberal arts is to study really what it means to be human, and to give ourselves the leisure to contemplate that in light of our ultimate end. This would then allow us to be able to put into proper perspective those things that many people, I think, value perhaps a little bit too much, their drive for a career, their insistence on a huge income, for example, or whatever the case may be. And in that sense, if they overemphasize those things to the exclusion of the others, the question then becomes, do we become more or less human?
I would like to go back to your question of should the colleges stay open. And I will say yes for many colleges. I'll say many, not most. And because I think this type of education requires a guide beyond me and my own mind sitting down trying to interpret the great works in order to better understand the human person. I mean, aren't guides, tutors, teachers necessary? Isn't this what a rightly ordered college would look like a place with substantial leisure time and courses in the humanities, theology, philosophy, these things. We don't have to worry about the proportions here. You said you don't want to nail those down. But on the one hand, I'm not sure a person could do that on their own in terms of self-teaching. On the other hand, as I've told humanities students before, I'm not sure this is the best way to study Dante. I think you should go read him under a tree somewhere, you know, during the summer when you have the time to just ingest it. But what they're not going to bring to that is the context that they might get from a history class or something they might learn from a poetry class, better to appreciate the poetry. All of that they're not going to be able to bring to their reading of Dante, I think, without the college education.
Right, I think. Now, despite my rhetorical flourish there, and it seems that I was attacking your vested interest in employment.
Yeah, it's all about my income. It's all about my vast income as an Aquinas professor. Yeah.
No, I think that colleges should stay open, but I think the thing that Shawl is pointing out is that a lot of colleges are disoriented. And so they do not nourish the human spirit. They do not allow the human spirit to flourish. And so that's why he talks of another sort of learning. And I think that in a college that's well ordered, that this kind of spiritual nourishing is beneficial to the student, because the student and the teacher are not they are co-seekers of the truth mm-hmm. together. And the student benefits really from the professor's already wading through things that are irrelevant. And so he can help or she can help focus the student's mind on that which seems to be most important.
If every generation reinvented the wheel, we'd have great difficulty.
Yeah, it would be a terrible thing.
That's why the past is important and not unimportant. That's why we started out talking about Augustine.
Yep.
Who's been gone from this world a very, very long time, but nevertheless still very important. This is Dr. John Pinero. You're listening to Faith and Reason on Holy Family Radio, Grand Rapids, Kalamazoo. I'm speaking with Dr. Dennis Marshall, professor of theology at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids. I'd like to take a turn now to make this more specific to one of your classes that is a very interesting class. We've talked about it before. I think our listeners would be interested in learning about your Wrestling with God class, because it deals with a lot of these issues about knowing God, about wrestling with the big questions, which all in some way, as you pointed out, relate to God. Can you tell us about your Wrestling with God course?
Yeah, well, my Wrestling with God course is, I think, my favorite course to teach, if I exclude the Christology course that I teach to my majors. But the Wrestling with God course is near and dear to me because, many years ago, I myself wandered the arid wastes of atheism, and so consequently, the question of God and how we resolve that, how we examine that in light of contemporary challenges, I think is an important question. The way that the course is structured is that is in the 16-week course is that the first half of the course is deals with what Christianity teaches about God, the human being, creation, and so on. And the reason that I structure it, at least in that the first half of the course in examining what Christianity teaches, is because atheism is a rejection of Christian teaching. Some people think oftentimes that atheism is just the rejection of any God. But if you look at the way that atheism has historically unfolded in the West, it is not the rejection of just any God. It's the rejection specifically of the Judeo-Christian understanding of who God is, the incarnation, and so on and so forth. So my students need to have a good understanding of what it is that Christianity teaches, so that then we can look at the atheists and see what it is that they are rejecting. And if we look at what the atheists are rejecting, then we can evaluate whether the atheists have what Christianity teaches right or not. In other words, are they rejecting really the Christian God, or are they rejecting something else? Is there some false idea or some emphasis in atheism that caused them to see not as clearly as they should what it is that Christianity actually teaches? So those are the kinds of, and I have a lot of fun with that because we deal with the thinkers like Augustine and Thomas Aquinas, St. Anselm of Canterbury and his arguments for God's existence. We talk about John Paul II's, St. John Paul II's Fides et Ratio, which is a marvelous document on the relationship between faith and reason. And then when we look at the atheists, I don't deal with the new atheists, say, of Dawkins, Dennett, or Hitchens, for example, but rather with the 19th century thinkers, Marx, Freud, Feuerbach, and Nietzsche.
Why the choice for those fellows as opposed to Dawkins at all?
Well, if you read the New Atheists, which I have, their understanding of Christianity is straw man. And it's not very well informed. Whereas you get Marx and Feuerbach, Freud and Nietzsche, they have a clearer and a better understanding of what Christianity is, and so what it is that they're rejecting. Feuerbach, for example, who was a theorist of socialism, he was a theologian, a Protestant theologian, who became an atheist and then an atheist political theorist. And so consequently, he understands clearly, or he knows clearly what it is that he is dealing with in his rejection of atheism. But when you read him, interestingly enough, a lot of his treatments of Christianity are caricatures. But a close reading of the text, which my students do, they come to realize that even the 19th century atheists don't perhaps get Christianity as right as they think they should.
What about Nietzsche? It seems to me that many modern theologians, particularly in the pages of First Things, you'll find an article on Nietzsche, it seems, every third or fourth issue, find some things in Nietzsche that at least identify certain modern problems or what life really would be like without God, as Nietzsche did. I mean, lamenting it, not praising it, and not setting up straw men, but saying this is where I think the modern mind and modernity is going, and I don't like it, but there's no way to turn back the clock.
Mm-hmm.
What about Nietzsche? Would he stand at the top of these folks in terms of a real thinker who's engaged in this?
When I was in graduate school a little over 20 years ago, one of my professors said that Nietzsche is the most serious challenger to Christian faith. And because I didn't know much of Nietzsche at the time, I pretty much accepted that view. And now, these decades later, I'm not so sure that I share that particular view. I don't think he's quite the nemesis that he was built up to be. But perhaps that's for another time.
Okay.
But I do want to say this about Nietzsche. Is one of the things that he does is that he has a great awareness of the fact that Christianity, during the time that he lived, had become a cultural artifact. And what I mean by a cultural artifact is that it was no longer a dynamic living faith that informed the culture. It was like a museum piece, a backdrop within which people's materialism, scientism, nihilism, so on and so forth, emerged out of. And so he's lamenting the fact that there's no longer the spiritual power that makes culture really vibrant and living. And so his he laments that. He diagnoses the spiritual ailment. And then, because nature abhors a vacuum, if God is really dead, well, then something's got to take its place, and hence his will to power. And so in order to fill the void of the death of God, you have the emergence of Nietzsche the God in order to take the place of God. Now, so so Nietzsche in that respect is important to understand him. He's also important to understand because many people today, especially postmodernists, would say that he is the father of postmodernism. And What is meant by that is that in postmodernism, there's this loss of confidence in the mind's ability to know reality. That the only thing that we have left is perspective or will or emotions, whatever we feel is whatever is true, and that's the only thing that is true. So with Nietzsche, you have this emergence of a type of skepticism that afflicts us today, our students today. And I think understanding Nietzsche is important in that regard. Do I think that Nietzsche can be responded to? Yes, I do. But that requires faith, and it requires a certain willingness to allow that the mind can know something. Oftentimes, Nietzscheans don't do that. As well as he may be able to identify a spiritual malaise on the part of Christianity, culturally speaking, the will to power isn't necessarily a remedy.
How many people whose thinking is actually Nietzschean would think of themselves in that way at all, or have ever read Nietzsche, or know that that's the case? I would say very few. I recall, you know, Alan Bloom in his Closing of the American Mind says there's one thing I can count on among all my students, and that is about 90% of them are going to be relativists.
Right.
And the minute they come into the classroom, even those who don't think they are, mm-hmm. it in some way are, when you start to peel them back, and mm-hmm. so that we get this trickle down effect from the intellectual elite and the philosophers and Nietzsche, etc., to the common person, and what we end up with by our point in time is just this radical individualism and the will to power, as you say, and a feeling that you know, even if I can know something, I'm not confident enough to say it's true for you. It may be true for me. You've heard someone say this, right? But it's not. That doesn't mean it's necessarily true for you. Which leads me back to even the name of a university, which touches on the idea of universal truth, or the university of truth that St. Thomas Aquinas talks about, so that no matter what we study, if it's true, it's somehow pointing to God. So this is why we do study chemistry, right? This is why we don't just have, as much as you might like all the classes to be theology classes, right? We do have other classes. We study that we want to know the truth about the past, the truth about the chemical makeup, biology, the way things work. Now, in your wrestling with God class, so when you're done with the atheists and those questions, where do you go from there?
Oh, we essentially finish up with
story?
Them. I always have planned to get into the question of suffering and the challenge that it poses to faith in God. Many thinkers think that, unlike the theoretical atheisms of, say, Marxism or Freudianism or whatever the case may be, they aren't real obstacles to belief in God. It's the real existential experience mm-hmm. of suffering that...
I know a good friend of mine is much like that. He believes. He makes the ascent of faith, but he often says he doesn't understand how, if it is true that God is omnipotent, how he would allow such great suffering, mm-hmm. if he's both omnipotent and good mm-hmm. and merciful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of Hume's argument too, David Hume. But I always ask my students this. I said, did your parents save you from every scrape that you ever, you know, incurred, from falling off your bike or tripping over the curb or whatever the case mm-hmm. may be? And the answer is no. I said, well, do you hold them to be evil on account of the fact that they didn't save you? Well, no, my parents are good parents. They'll respond to me.
But those are scrapes.
But it's also suffering, in the sense that you know, anybody, and you yourself are, well, I don't know how far Lucia is walking, but when she takes
she's
a real
got a,
fall.
She's got a few bumps
and,
on her
I'm
lately.
Sure.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Have you noticed, though, that when she gets up from those, she comes running to you and she's crying with her arms open, and the closer she gets, the louder she wails? Have you noticed that? Until what? You can swoop her up in your arms and you can hold her, and then you calm her down and so on and so forth. Well, because we're free human beings, God allows us to exercise our freedom in such a way in which suffering becomes a real possibility. But we don't have a problem with that. You know, if something is my fault and the suffering I cause, we don't have a problem with that. We have a problem with what we would consider to be unjust suffering.
Or even animal suffering.
Right.
Even that.
Yeah, or even something like that. And the problem is that we're confronted with the problem of Job. And the problem of Job is to try to make sense intellectually of what transcends our understanding, namely God. What's God's will and what's God's design and so on and so forth. And of course, people could accuse me of saying, oh, you're just punting and placing it in God's lap. And to a certain extent, I am, but in another respect, I'm not. Because if God creates a world in which he makes it possible for suffering to occur, he doesn't cause it, but makes it possible for suffering to occur, then in some sense, God is ultimately responsible for that suffering. And so the answer to the question then, ultimately, is the cross. Is Christ suffering on the cross? That's where God takes responsibility for the sin, the death, and the evil that was incurred by us through our disobedience against God from the beginning. And it's in that particular cross in which suffering then can be made sense of. Karl Rahner, who I did my dissertation on with regard to this question, the question of suffering, was always accused of not having a theodicy, a rational justification of God's goodness in the face of suffering. And he never attempted to do one. But what he did do was a spirituality, in which he communicates to us this notion that from the moment we're born, conceived really, we're dying. And God administers our death one day at a time. In that sense, then, we are ones who are living towards death. Everything that we do, no matter how wonderful it may be, is not going to be lasting. It's going to die along with us. Well, Rahner says then, but our life is much more significant than this, to be sure. Even God, you know, suffered on the cross in order for us to be redeemed from this kind of futility. So, for Rahner, the answer to suffering is the way that we live towards God by offering up every aspect of our lives to him every day, from the smallest sufferings to the greatest sufferings. And as we discipline ourselves in giving ourselves up to God, from the littlest sufferings to the greatest sufferings, is that when we're confronted with those existentially challenging moments like death, that we will do what we've been doing all along and giving our lives over to God. And in finding it, then, he talks about a spirituality of suffering by which we live in such a way that we continually to give our entire selves to God as a gift, no matter what the circumstance is. And therein, then, we're going to find the answer. But the answer is not going to be rationally satisfying, if you understand that, because our reason is simply radically incapable of understanding God's will and the purpose of suffering in our lives at that particular moment or in that particular time.
So, that's very profound. So most of the great questions, then, and including this one, always comes down to faith then, doesn't it? I mean, there's the aspect that the distance you can go with reason, and then faith has to enter in. That's not to say God is a God of the gaps, as it were, but to say that that's an unanswerable question then, just using reason.
Well, I don't know if it's an unanswerable question.
There's no satisfying answer.
But it's an unresolvable one according to reason. I was reading this morning a commentary by Reinhard Hutter. His book, Dustbound for Heaven, actually is quite good. He was talking about how it is that when you live in an era that seeks to rationally dominate everything, then even theological questions become problems to be solved. But in Christianity, theology, because of the inadequacy of the mind's ability to grasp God, is theology is not a problem to be solved. It's a mystery to be lived. So Augustine and Aquinas and the great theological saints, Catherine of Siena and so on and so forth, they would say that we're invited to ever live more deeply the mystery of the triune God as it's manifested in our lives, because there the understanding lies, not the solvability of the issue, but the understanding in this relationship with the triune God. And if we only live on the fringes of that without entering into it deeply, then we're going to insist that God answer questions according to the meagerness of our own intellect, rather than to answer the question with himself in his complete giving of himself to us, which is the radical transformation of our lives.
I recall Dr. Eduardo Echevarria, when he was at Aquinas, kept repeating over and over again a phrase that I think was from St. John Paul II, that Jesus Christ is the answer to the question that is every human life.
Yes.
Dr. John Panero, I've been speaking with Dr. Dennis Marshall, professor of theology at Aquinas College. Now, a lot of our listeners are sitting there saying, I wish I could take a class from Dr. Marshall, but I can't. But maybe I will. Maybe I'll enroll in a class or two. Our listeners should know that you and I, a couple of years ago, we led the orientation for the Catholic secondary schools in Grand Rapids, talking about just these issues, and it had a great time. Doing it. More recently, I did something similar with our Grand Rapids seminarians. I also had a great time doing that. Now, folks can come and hear a free lecture of yours at Sacred Heart. Do you know the date of that?
I believe it's August 7th.
Okay.
And there are going to be beer and burgers and hot dogs prior to the talk. And I can't remember the title of the talk. Mark Postma made it sound like we're going to be in Hobbiton, but it's going to be on leisure and the contemplation of God.
And I think that's the launch of their Catechetical Foundations Authenticum series for 2014 to 2015. I think you're launching.
I didn't know that I was the inaugural speaker.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
looking forward to that.
And if not, hey, it's what a great thing. So kind of outdoor barbecue, yep. Not a pork barbecue, but the hot dogs, hamburgers, that kind of thing. And I'll be looking forward to that. I plan to be there, and I would encourage our listeners to attend as well. I like to give guests towards the end of the program. We have just a couple minutes left. If there's anything you would like to recommend our listeners to see, to read, maybe it's a couple books that might encapsulate for the educated listener, but maybe not the listener with a degree in theology, but just the educated Catholic listener and our non-Catholic listeners as well, what you might point them towards doing, seeing, reading.
Well, there are a couple books that I would encourage you to read. One of them is a book from the 1920s by A.G. Sertolange called The Intellectual Life. That will give you some kind of idea of the importance of disciplining the mind and continuing one's education by reading good books throughout one's life and forming one's heart and mind in relationship to what is true and good and beautiful. So I highly recommend that. I love Jay Budashevsky's books. He wrote a book called The Line Through the Heart on Natural Law as fact, theory, and sign of contradiction. Outstanding. Any of his books that you can read are simply outstanding with regard to the natural law.
Yeah, we recently had him on the program. Yeah. And what a great interview.
He's marvelous. I think he's the best natural law thinker in the United States today, although I'm sure Robert George would give a good contest for that. And then finally, I would recommend reading St. Augustine's Confessions, his Trinity and the City of God. You can't read them quickly, but you can certainly read them slowly and thoughtfully and benefit from them greatly.
Thank you very much. I've read that list, but not Budashevsky's book, the one you mentioned, but I remember reading the Sertolange. What's the title again?
The Intellectual Life.
The Intellectual Life on your recommendation. I think it was last summer, probably last summer. And it's concise and very, very insightful. And it's one of those kind of books that you best just not start underlining, because I found myself underlining too much. And so sometimes that's a good danger with some books, that every sentence packs something that's worth your reflection and significant time thinking. So I very much appreciated that. Well, Dr. Marshall, thank you very much for coming on Faith and Reason today.
You're welcome, John. Happy to be here.
Thank you. I hope we can have you back. I've really been impressed with the theology department at Aquinas ever since I've been there in 2004. It was the same three of you. I came in the same year as Dr. Davis, and Dr. Marco is, of course, also in the department. And I think our students are blessed to have your department. We appreciate your department's full participation in Catholic studies as well. And I would encourage our listeners to take a look at that. And thank you very much, dear listener, for tuning in to Faith and Reason. This is Dr. John Pinheiro. And I hope that you have a very good day. Thank you for listening to Holy Family Radio.
You've been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr. John Pinheiro, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Pinheiro is Professor of History and Director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith and Reason is brought to you by Holy Family Radio. I'm your program producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Join us next time as we connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. Thanks for listening.